I spoke with him at a recent conference on internationalism that was held by the Rebuilding the Left Initiative in Toronto.
My first question would just be to ask what the situation in South Africa is like today, given that we're now in a second term in majority rule South Africa, that there is no formally racist government that exists there anymore.
It's 7 years since the first democratic election in the country in 1994, and to sketch broadly what's happened, it's first of all hugely liberating not to have the racial laws. The success of the ANC in achieving a dignity for black people can never be discounted, and for a white expatriate like myself, never really fully comprehended. But that said, it's also quite true that the socio-economic conditions of the vast majority of the people have declined. The standard of living has declined. The number of jobs has declined dramatically by some estimates of 1 million formal sector jobs. While there are some expanded rights for organized labor, by and large the downward pressure on wages has kept wages below productivity levels. So you have for big business, a net decline in the real unit cost of labor, but maybe most importantly, that's been rewarded with the most extraordinary looting of the country's wealth by white business. It's really heated up in the last couple of years, but right from the beginning, the white business community, which is the entire business community, there's only about 2% of business that's controlled by black big business, and of course there's a large informal sector, maybe 7 or 8% of the economy. But that white business community, and especially the English-speaking whites and the large conglomerates, and I'll name some names, Anglo-American Corporation, Old Mutual Insurance Company, South African Breweries, the De Beers Company, which is linked to Anglo-American Corporation, the Didata high-tech company, the major companies, in short, in South Africa have delisted from the Johannesburg Stock Exchange in favor of the London Stock Exchange. So we've seen since about 1997 quite a substantial flight of corporate headquarters, and also then since last year that's translated into an outflow of dividends and profits to London, and it was brought to a climax about 3 months ago when the De Beers Corporation turned from a privately held company into the company a publicly held company, publicly traded company on the stock market, into a privately held company by the Oppenheimer family. So what we've been seeing then is the process of the looting of South Africa by white unpatriotic capital as a reward for the most extraordinary concessions that the ANC government has made, and just to name a few, not only allowing them to get out of the country, which they could have been prevented from doing, also lowering their corporate taxes from 48% in 1994 to 30% today, adopting a structural adjustment program that the World Bank helped to design in 1996 that has reduced the standard of living of the masses, and also liberalized capital and trade flow so that the former exchange controls being lifted have allowed rich white folks to take their money to offshore financial centers. Time after time after time, big business has been treated with extraordinary generosity. And I think even the most neoliberal currents in the ANC are beginning to ask themselves, hey, maybe we've gone just a little bit too far. Maybe we've given these folks that in the white business community too much, and we've gotten too little out of them. So that at least is encouraging, but of course it can only really be reversed by mass action on the ground, and that too is looking up and has made the ANC government, even in the last 6 months, agree that free water and electricity for a basic lifeline supply will be provided at some point. I mean, it's being sabotaged by bureaucrats and officials in municipalities, but at least we're beginning to see mass mobilization again, the strength of the unions, the muscles beginning to be flexed, and a whole lot of independent progressive initiatives in different communities, a women's movement beginning to arise, the church is becoming more political, youth looking for outlets for their activism. And finally, the standard response to this kind of pressure that we've seen across Africa after independence, namely a kind of defensive and paranoid version of nationalism, a sort of reversion to, as is happening in Zimbabwe, mythologies of of liberation struggle. That's not going to go all that far in South Africa, because I think the working class is very well organized, the social movements, the environmentalists are coming back and saying that kind of nationalism doesn't hold much sway when our conditions of life are getting worse.
So can I just step back a moment and ask you what you mean by concessions exactly, and perhaps how does this relate to globalization?
Yeah, there are two broad based ways to answer that. One is that just in order to get to democracy, the leaders, especially Nelson Mandela and his lieutenants, like our current president, Thabo Mbeki, and Cyril Ramaphosa, the former trade unionist, even Joe Slovo, who died in 1995 but was instrumental in establishing the contours of the compromises. All of those leaders felt, notwithstanding an upsurge in very, very strong grassroots and shop floor protest in the early 90s, they felt that the only way to really get rid of apartheid was to break the relationship between white English-speaking business and the National Party, the old apartheid white rulers. And that decision to try and expand the nature of the alliance to bring in big business meant that even early on, 92, 93, the old promises of nationalization, of the mines and monopoly capital, massive redistribution of land, those promises from the 1955 Freedom Charter were already more or less thrown out. Corporations in 93 were already being given human rights protections in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and so we were already seeing the aspirations of the majority being sabotaged by compromises just to get to democracy. And then in 1994, 95, 96, it's a crucial period when the World Bank and the IMF sent in missions. It was a big IMF loan in December 93 of $850 million. And these missions of advisory teams come in 94, 95, 96, and are instrumental in drafting most of the macroeconomic and social and development policies. And in each of those, you find the fingerprints of the World Bank teams promoting a kind of neoliberal, a free market approach. And so already the second way of explaining the nature of the concessions and the compromises is to revert to the slogan that globalization made me do it. Globalization made me do it. Reverting to the prestige and the international power of the World Bank and IMF to say that's the way they do it elsewhere, we should do it that way. It didn't take long before the contradictions emerged, and none of the programs, including macroeconomics, models that the World Bank has provided have delivered the good. So we're just in that process now of trying to undo the enormous damage by international neoliberal advisors in the first part of that period, 94 through 96, but still the waves of advisors, the pressure continues. It's currently taking the form of pressure to privatize large chunks of the South African state, and the one that's under most contestation right now is electricity, because in order to privatize, the electricity company is cutting off electricity of low-income people, for example, in Soweto, where there's a huge resistance against it, and nationally is pushing for huge cuts in the numbers of workers. So in early August, we'll be seeing a two-day national stay-away, a mass strike by the trade unions, I think supported by the vast majority of folks in the society who understand that this process of privatization pressure from Washington and from international financiers and local neoliberals is going to do a lot of damage to their standards of living, and also, however, can be resisted. And that's the tension. ANC embodies groups that include South African Communist Party and the trade unions and social movements that want the free electricity that was promised for the ANC to win a good majority, 60% in last December's municipal elections. But on the other hand, the pressure to privatize the electricity company, water, and so forth, means that that promise is bound to be broken, and it is being broken. So that's the extraordinary contradiction within the ANC, and I suspect it'll only be in the next 5 years a break of the alliance and the trade unions finally getting fed up and walking out that'll allow the left more generally to cohere and to fight globalization from outside the alliance, where I think probably will be much more effective.
To do that, this requires some kind of shift in the way that people actually understand the legacy of apartheid, and I guess I'm wondering how you envision that shift being made.
In the late 80s, it was a very explicitly anti-capitalist current that was driving the movement, and it was dominant in the trade unions and civic groups that reflected quite a strong consciousness of the interrelationship between racism and capitalism. With formal racism gone, what the phraseology is certainly about sort of the problems associated with the free market neoliberalism, a sort of mode that across the world is being associated with the World Bank, IMF, the rise of finance. But I think deep down it is more and more being associated with the commodification of life, with capitalism penetrating all spheres of life in areas like water, where cutting off people's water where they once had free water has led to an outbreak over the last 10 months of cholera that's claimed 100,000 victims, over 200 deaths. But 100,000 people have got cholera because of its increasing association with commodification, capitalism. And I think that is actually the direction of left politics. It'll probably be, as you correctly point out, difficult, as it has been in many African countries where the nationalist legacy, the liberation movement, the first post-colonial era of building states, and then the reversion to IMF World Bank programs, the decline in the standards of living as a result, the increasing political repression that goes with trying to run structural adjustment programs in countries like Zambia, or Namibia or Zimbabwe. In all of those countries, the left has now broken free at one level. Trade unions were the basis for forming new post-nationalist parties. However, in their attempts to wrest political power from the nationalist post-liberation governments, they in turn had to look to neoliberal allies, big business, or themselves, as in Zambia and possibly as in Zimbabwe, have been suckered into adopting neoliberalism themselves. And so the big challenge for South Africa is to be post-nationalist and post-neoliberal. And to get there, it really requires that the balance of forces shift more decisively to the left. I think that's very feasible in the coming period. So I retain a great optimism that South Africa will be different, largely because of the great strength and democratic traditions in the working class organizations.
And that actually means something very real on the ground when we talk about nationalism in South Africa, where you have a situation where South Africans and certainly the South African government are victimizing migrant labor from Mozambique
and Zimbabwe and other countries. It's not simply the government. I mean, the government has a pretty backward immigration policy, but it's also, there's a consciousness in the working class facing desperation, facing the million job losses, that Mozambicans are coming to take their jobs away. And it's a false consciousness, to be sure, but to build the regionalism from below that will overcome that is going to require that the trade unions really bring some life into their regional groupings, and that that very, very explicit work in the community organizations to overcome the xenophobia be done. It's a very serious problem, and it's one that continues, as in most countries around the world, to divide and rule the working class.
What's so ironic about it as well is that the ANC itself was based in some of these countries for periods of time throughout the liberation struggle, and the liberation of these surrounding countries like Mozambique played such a key role in ending apartheid. And now we see people like Nelson Mandela and Thabo Mbeki, people who were former members of, Thabo Mbeki was a former member of the Communist Party, the people who were directly involved in that struggle. And now they seem to be forming an attack on the very people who brought them to power.
I think it's probably less at the level of those personalities. I mean, Nelson Mandela himself, for example, married the widow of Samora Machel, Grace Machel. I think the attack comes in the form of what we can, I think, fairly openly now call South Africa's sub-imperialist regional trade, investment, financial, and even foreign policy. I mean, the invasion of Lesotho in September 98, with the death of a few dozen Basotho soldiers defending the big dam up the hills, was some reflection of that, and the recent purchase of 10 billion Canadian dollars worth of very sophisticated weaponry, clearly for use in Southern Africa and maybe as far as north as the DRC, as a sort of sub-imperial policeman for Western interests. That specter does loom. It's been very, very tragic in the form of the regional trade and investment processes, because the Johannesburg companies, the exporters from South Africa with huge economies of scale and large capital-intensive production structures and smaller markets at home, have really been pushing into the region and destroying the local manufacturing sectors in Zambia and Zimbabwe, for example.
It seems very clear that this relates to broader processes of globalization, that people in Canada and North America and all around the world are mobilizing to oppose. What does this mean for people who are listening right here, who have not really had much contact with South Africa? How can they be involved in this ongoing struggle and relate to it?
Well, I think the progressives in Toronto, your listeners, are probably already on board the same train that the progressive forces in South Africa named. Namely, to look at these international institutions and move to close them down, whether it's by showing up their meetings. I hope all your listeners are going to be in Washington at the end of September, early October, for the big protests at the World Bank and IMF that are being sponsored by 50 Years is Enough, www.50years.org. And also to join Jubilee Canada, which is the best of the Northern Jubilee movements, really pushing for the cancellation of third world debt, including apartheid debt. And that's something that the Jubilee South movement has been exceptionally strong in demanding, not simply highly indebted poor country initiatives with some structural adjustment conditions, but the full-fledged cancellation, repudiation, and even the demand for reparations from northern financiers for the damage done by third world debt, as well as ecological debt that the north owes the south. And I think if there's one particular institution, I'll mention, by the way, that Jubilee South, the coalition of these really fantastic militant Jubilee movements, can be seen at http://aidc.org.za. No, www, that's aidc.org.za. And I think to find a really surgical way between these big demonstrations to make these anti-globalization arguments heard and to stop the hemorrhaging of flows of finance from the south to the north, and even from South Africa to London, we are looking at one particular institution, the World Bank, as a major nerve center of the Washington consensus, neoliberalism, the pressure points. And so there's a movement to defund the World Bank, that the South African Jubilee 2000 group, with their allies in the movement of the landless in Brazil, the movement against structural adjustment in Haiti, Filipino debt activists, and many others have been pushing. And that's the World Bank bonds boycott, so that your Canadian pension funds, your municipal funds, your social responsible investment funds, your church investments and university endowments, those investment managers are told by your democratic movements here not to profit from poverty by having World Bank bonds in their portfolio in future, by not ever buying another World Bank bond. A lot of major U.S. institutions, even the city of San Francisco, already endorsed this, and I think it's very much an opportunity now for Canada to move with the international movement and take the call in the spirit of solidarity from the South, from South Africa, and say, hey, let's close that World Bank. I hope everyone shows up in Washington and meets my comrades from South Africa, who will be there, hopefully for the last World Bank meeting ever.
You have been listening to Patrick Bond on Red Alert Radio, the radio show of the Toronto New Socialist Group. Please tune in again next week, as we will be airing another interview with Patrick Bond on the process of land reform and the recent occupations in Zimbabwe.